inch by inch, row by row, someone bless these seeds I sowed. Someone warm them from below.
Good morning. This is the Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and I'm speaking this morning with Ali Sharif, who is the founder of IPERMO, an institute for permaculture in Mozambique. Before that, he started the organization PAL in Latin America. While in Latin America, Ali Sharif established permaculture projects and demonstration centers, building schools, farms, hosting courses, convening international conferences, and forming local NGOs in Ecuador, Peru, and throughout Brazil. Ali Sharif, thanks very much for coming into KBOO today.
Thank you, Kathleen. Appreciate it.
I read that you were instructed to take permaculture to Latin America by Bill Mollison, who is considered the father of permaculture. Can you talk about your beginning experiences with this work?
Yes. I took my course in 1984 in Whidbey Island in Washington, and Bill taught it on his own. And it's an exhausting 72-hour presentation. And at the end of it, in those days, at the end of the course, he would go around with a tape recorder and he'd put the microphone right in your face. And he said, well, Ali, what are you going to do with all this information that you've now learned? And, you know, I'm on the spot and I knew exactly. I said I was in. I'm in, Bill, and I will spend the rest of my life doing permaculture. It had been such a gift. And so I helped establish the organization Permacultura America Latina, which was iconic because it was the first organization that began looking for funds for Latin American projects, permaculture projects, and it introduced the private sector to permaculture. And so then I literally asked Bill, well, where should I go? You know, and he said, well, you choose where you go, but Latin America is a good place because we don't have anyone there. We got some people in Africa. We got some people in Asia. No one's in South America. So I had one contact in Ecuador, and so I went there. And 27 years later, after being in the Amazon, you know, Bill comes to visit in 2007. And he sees all the projects, and they're big by now. You know, some important people have visited. Prince Charles visited, you know, spent a day. He called one of the projects a virtuous circle. So Bill took me by the arm and he said, Ali, enough's enough. You know, you should go to Africa. So, you know, I followed Bill's instructions because after I left Iran, escaped from Iran, revolutionary Iran, I'd come to the United States and I was really going perhaps down the wrong path. You know, I was an angry young man. I was doing things that I shouldn't be doing. And then I met Bill and I did this course, and it was such a turnaround. It was such a gift. And he basically told me that don't ever deny anything that you've done or thought about or anything of your past. Just figure out how you can turn it around so it can be a solution. So it was such a gift to me that I realized I could go anywhere and be confident and be a part of the solution. So that's how it started, and that's what, you know, I felt a lot more confident after 27 years in the Amazon, believe me. And so I went to Africa, and I traveled Zambia, Malawi, South Africa, Mozambique, and I finally settled on Mozambique as the logical place to start. I had one contact there, an organization that worked with children's rights, and they helped me establish this nonprofit IPERMO, mm-hmm. and begin work in a rural very poor, marginalized area south of the capital city of Maputo. And that's where we established the IPERMO's administrative and operational base, right in the community. Yeah, not in the city and visited in an African rural tribal community. There's a world of difference.
Mm. Yeah. And you, let's talk a minute about what were some of the projects that your organization became involved in Latin America, and then we'll talk about the ones in Mozambique and some of the differences.
Well, my job really came down to establishing reference centers in the absence of any infrastructure or any the issues of sustainability. They all came much later. We're talking 1988, 89. And I remember writing proposals. It took half a page just to define permaculture and sustainability. And of course, now you just say the words and nothing needs more to be said, you know. But so that's what I did. And reference centers are, of course, food, water, energy, shelter, sanitation, and education combined in a way that they're all mutually beneficial infrastructures, and they become a teaching tool so that you can then begin your courses and your vocational courses. And from there, you take it on, you know. It's very, very important to understand that when you're dealing in third world countries, especially in Africa, you can't talk about change. You can't talk about the things that you want to do or you should do. You have to be able to point to them, because why would they believe you? Why should they believe you? How would they know what you're talking about in the absence of any comparison with anything else? You know, it's like trying to explain what a green light is to somebody. You have to point to it, you know. And so it became very easy as a permaculturist to begin any kind of new process in that context of building a reference center. Yeah.
Okay. So that's like an informational educational center.
Yes.
And people can come there and get resources for the projects they're working on?
Yes.
Okay.
Books and magazines and courses are taught, and see things in a natural context, not something strange. Every roof captures its water, you know, harvests its rainwater. The water is filtered so people can drink it, then it's used in the fish pond or growing vegetables. It's all part of a natural cycle. Nothing's unusual about it. It's just the way it should be.
Right. And so what has happened in those countries that you worked in, Ecuador, Peru, and Brazil, in those years, in that 30 years ago compared to now, as far as the approach to permaculture and sustainability?
Brazil, now permaculture is mainstream. The big entities that fund permaculture, groups like Petrobras and Banco Brasil and large entities, Odebrecht, these fund permaculture projects. They prefer permaculture projects because they're obliged to engage in ecological restoration and to maintain ecological restoration. And of course, wherever there's they work in a reserve or a vast expanse of forest. They're social communities, so they're obliged to relate to their needs and requirements. And it's an ideal situation for permaculture. And these guys give big bucks now. I'm no longer there. I'm small fry where I am in Africa. But these big entities give $1 million grants to permaculture proposals. So, you know, it's pretty mainstream when you get to that level. And mm-hmm. You don't have to define permaculture anymore.
But some of the big entities, not maybe those particular ones, but some are a source of destruction and other aspects of environmental damage. Can you talk about the challenges for countries like Brazil?
Brazil has wonderful legislation to protect the natural ecology, especially the Amazon. Wonderful. It's all there. It's so difficult implementing that protective capacity. It's so vast. In the old days, you know, it was really going down in boats. And, you know, now, of course, you've got drones. And you've got, you know, indigenous communities are connected by the internet. And they can, but still, it's incredibly, incredibly difficult to visually reconnaissance vast areas. You're talking hundreds of thousands of square kilometers all, you know, it's vast, vast areas. So it's very, very difficult. Reconstruction of damaged areas in Brazil is now known how to do it. We know how to do it. We've learned. We've got the information down. And everything to do with species lists, and there's such a body of information that it's all there. So, you know, in many ways, Brazil spoiled it for me. You know, I mean, it was the lap of ecological luxury. There were so many well-educated people on site who were so well-informed. It really, and, you know, Africa is very much is in contrast to a lot of that. There's, you know, projects are few and far between, and the ones that are really good are even farther apart, and there's not so many people that are right on it, you know.
Uh-huh. So what would be an example of a project that would be happening in Mozambique, for example, that would be an example of permaculture? It's knowing that the landscape there is so much different from that of Latin America.
Well, you know, I've been there now going into my sixth year, and I went there with all the preconceptions that are so easy to take with one, especially if one's been successful somewhere else. It's that's human nature. Everything about Africa is different. So you really have to start understanding that. Perhaps I can explain a little bit better. When I went to this very rural region, it's marginalized, it's isolated, there's all kinds of diseases. There is no potable groundwater, which is the single biggest challenge, because all agriculture is rain-fed. And with the variabilities of climate change, and the communities in my particular region are those that were resettled after the Civil War. It was a 12-year-old, very brutal Civil War. And there was international pressure on the government to resettle something like 4 million displaced people and refugees. 12 years is a long time. And so people got shunted into, you know, areas where there wasn't groundwater, potable groundwater. And sometimes there were different tribal groups and lingual groups. And, you know, it's in these settlements that they pre-existed, but they didn't have a traditional architecture where the rest of the country, all the rural areas have, where they have, you know, a central area, a food growing area, the houses. There's a defined nucleus. But in these settled areas, it's just people were given plots of land and it covered vast areas. So it was very difficult providing the services that one normally would do. And this is where it gets very difficult, because any person of consciousness, you know, might have ideas. Well, I'm going to do a reference center there. You know, I did it in Brazil and all these places. But, you know, you see every day children drinking water out of puddles where the goats were drinking, and, you know, where cattle had stamped on, and they have big stomachs, and you have to deal with it right away, whatever your preconceptions, whatever your plans or your designs were. That's something you have to take care of today. And so things change. You adapt to circumstances more than you would other places.
Mm-hmm.
And the circumstances are very grave. You know, they're very thin margins in these rural communities. You're talking $1 a day communities which have been hit by HIV, which have been hit by tuberculosis. They're marginalized. They're probably peri-urban, so there's an element of, you know, city violence or whatever it is. It's a task. It's a real task.
Mm-hmm. And so is there a project there now where some of these survivors of HIV are actually part of a permaculture project?
Yes. My project, I had to think carefully, well, how can I be of service in such a crisis situation that was before me? And I learned, you know, there's some things that have to be learned by permaculturalists, by folks regarding permaculture. Permaculturalists speak specialization, but they think as generalists. And when you come to have to respond to a community development program, which was what my job was, a sustainable community development program, one can't pick and choose, okay? One has to create some kind of concept that applies to the whole community. Otherwise, you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, if you work with the mom, the dad's going to get upset. You know, you work with the kids, well, the mom gets neglected. You know, it's like the whole thing has to. But we had to take care of this water and food security right away. And initially, that dealt primarily with kids because we didn't have any infrastructure, but there was a school building. And so that meant there was a school roof, which meant that we could capture the rainforest, we could filter it, and we could provide. And every kid now gets 1.5 liters of potable drinking water every day. So I don't have that medical data. I don't have those facilities of laboratories. But just looking at kids, they don't have those big stomachs anymore. And they smile and jump around like kids do.
Mm-hmm.
The food security program, we started growing in the reference center. We built the classrooms, we built the storage rooms, we built the administrative offices. We did all of that, and of course, we did vegetable gardens and mandala gardens and all the things Permis do. We also built a dam that was just on the outskirts of the community, which captured flood water. And from that, now there is 14 hectares of vegetable cultivation using that water as irrigated water. And we've done that in some other places. So we are reaching the whole. What we're doing in the context of the reference center on a day-by-day basis is that all the food that we produce, and there's ducks and there's fish and there's chickens and every kind of vegetable you can think of, and a particular emphasis on medicinal plants. We have the Moringa oleifera as an agroforestal system where we grow vegetables underneath. And we have the Artemisia annua, which is the malaria preventative plant. And we mix all these up into a daily meal for the orphans, the community and the regional orphans and the children born with HIV. And they get one high protein stacked with medicinal plants. We don't really know the measurements exactly, but we make sure there's a lot of it in there. You know, better safe than sorry. And as we've now established a bakery, you know, the kids go home. We also give them a loaf of bread for the daily, and maybe at some point in the future we'll have something to put in it, mm-hmm. in the sandwich. But that's a protein-packed one. And, you know, those kids, when they came to us, they were a sorry-looking lot. I mean, they were – and now they're kids. You know, they jump around and you know, they do kid things, you know. And we're now considering extending to them the computer education that we give to the school. as a specialized form to give them a leg up, these kids.
You know. So this is, in a sense, because of your connection, your original connection to the school through your contact there that you have.
Yes,
yeah, yeah. The programs grow out of that, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, I want to make sure we touch on climate change a little bit more if possible. Have you seen effects of it since you've been in Mozambique?
Sure. We're still in the tail end. I'm hoping it's the tail end of a 13-14 month drought. Earlier this year, the temperatures got to 45 degrees. That's around about 118 degrees Fahrenheit. And, you know, you have very little ozone. And being a white boy, you know, I'm very much aware of that, you know. And you know, it's so hot, the ground's cracking up, and you have to deal with these difficulties. They're serious difficulties, yes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a lot of the regional, we're in the dry, arid tropics, subtropics. So we're at the forefront of climate change. And to make matters worse, the forests that it did exist all around us, small forests, dwarf forests, most of those were cut down during the Civil War because people couldn't stay in their communities at night because this was a very serious war that was going on. It was very bloody. It was very violent. It was a proxy war between CIA and KGB. This is the Cold War era. And people slept in the forest. It was the dormitory. You ate there. I mean, there was wild game to be had. You know, it's like you slept in the trees, made tree houses, and you went back into the town during the day. So a lot of those trees went. So it adds to that climate severity.
Right. And just talking about drought, it's hard to imagine that there would be the ability to capture rainwater when a country is in drought.
Well, yes, and it's been very, very difficult for us. We had something like 1 million liters of water stored in our water tanks and fish tanks and all kinds of tanks. We went over, just really took on this issue, and we used ferrocement technology. I don't know if you know what ferrocement is, but if you're into the water tank business, ferrocement's the way to go. It's wire cage. You use three materials, chicken wire, malia. I don't know what the other one is. It's a 10-centimeter square fencing. It's like fencing. And baling wire to sew it all up. We actually built a three-story building with this technology. It's the only three-story ferrocement building in the world, but that's where our administrative center is. We have a visitor's lodge on the roof and on the ground. It's the marketplace where we sell and vegetables and sort of the commercial area. And there's a water tank below that pumps the water to the – there's a tank on the very top, and that gravity feeds water to all the vegetable gardens. And this swales in the landscape, and we've got ponds. So we captured a lot of water. So we were spared the horrors of what could have happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Ali Sharif. He founded IPERMO, an institute for permaculture in Mozambique. Before that, working close to 30 years or 27 years in Latin America on these permaculture centers. We have just a few minutes left, Ali. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the future and what do you think the big issues are coming up for permaculture and these projects in the area you're working in?
Well, it's so important that we provide trained people. And trained people requires intensive training. I've personally discovered that it's wonderful that people can go and teach courses and be useful overseas. But in third world countries like Africa, those people don't stay. They go back to their home countries in the US or Europe. And in third world countries, in African countries, it's so very important that they see your face the next day, because you're not there, and it's very difficult for whatever they've learned to take it forward, because there's no resources to be able to make something of what you've learned. Here in the U.S., of course, there are those resources. There isn't. So it's very important that if somebody is serious about doing something, they're physically there for that length of period of time that's required. We're going to try and get as much of our information as possible into a website that's going to be coordinated from here in Portsmouth.
Portland.
And the contact, I think, is yourself, or it's Carolina.
Carolina,
and it's,
it's
www.permacultura.org. And
permaculture.
And that will be up in a month or so. And right. We're going to get a lot of that information up. And we're going to take it from there and see where it is. But it's really about seeing some of the difficulties of these countries and ways that people can help, how they can help. And obviously the website's the mechanism to stay in touch. We only got the internet earlier this year. And so I'd fallen off the radar. Mm-hmm. When I had 6 years in Africa, I went some sort of large projects to sort of going off the radar. And it's now with having got the internet and I'm visiting the U.S. and I'm going to be visiting every year for a month. And so I'm going to put all that I've learned on the table so that there is some knowledge of what it takes to take a rural African village, a very resource-poor region, marginalized and with diseases and all the problems of the world and poverty at its very base, what it takes to turn it around, how much time, how much money, what the skill sets required, how many people. I want to get that database so that there is some kind of methodology that has been adapted to Africa.
Well, Ali Sharif, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking about this while you were in Portland, and let people know again that that website is going to be called permacultura.org, permacultura. .org. That will be coming up in the near future, and we hope to get information about that here at KBOO for people who might want that later on this year. So thank you again for coming.
Cheers. In. Thank you very much.
Yes. And again, my guest has been Ali Sharif, founder of IPERMO, an institute for permaculture in Mozambique, and before that, many years of working in Latin America on permaculture projects and demonstration centers and many projects. This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine. Stay tuned.
Feel the need to grow my own.